Welcome to episode 55 of Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. The holiday is approaching for us. That's Christmas, but we have a recipe that's good for any time of year, really. It's the biscotti, which most of you probably know. The biscotti is Italian for twice baked. So it's interesting to me that we get biscuit from biscotti, which biscuits are not really twice baked. Cookies in general, but these are, and what's really nice about them is they get really nice and crisp. So they are a perfect pairing with your tea or coffee, or what I like is Vinsanto. So it's a dessert wine from Italy, which is unfortunately really expensive, at least here. I don't think it's that expensive in Italy, but it's wonderful to dip in your Vinsanto.
Well, and I have to say, Booty, I remember being introduced to it when you studied abroad in Italy for a semester, and you came back with the gift of a bottle of Vinsanto and some biscotti. And that got me curious. And right about at that time, the local paper, well, I'm not sure what paper it was in, but and it's the recipe has so disintegrated that I've lost the top and the bottom and all of the instructions too. So we'll put it on the website, bootyandbossy.com. You can look it up there and you can see a picture of exactly what I mean. But this was a recipe that I found right about the time I think that you came back from Italy, and I've been making it ever since. I've actually doubled the original recipe because I just find that if you're going to make them, you should make extra because everybody loves them. And I often, as a Christmas gift, will have a little bag of biscotti with hot chocolate, and then I'll make some of the marshmallows. That's a nice little ensemble. And they're pretty easy to make, and they're great because everybody's always like, oh, you made those? And they're really not hard. But everybody should pretend that they're hard and say, yes, I labored over these. This is truly an expression of love and appreciate every bite.
Well, and I do think anything homemade is an expression of love.
Yes.
And these definitely are really popular. Well, you said it all, really. They're easy to make, but they are kind of unusual.
So here's the recipe from some newspaper that I can't find anymore. I have doubled the recipe, and I've adjusted it a little bit. But so you're going to cream together 2 sticks of butter, unsalted or salted or fine, with 1.5 cups of sugar. And you're going to cream that together, and then you're going to add 4 eggs, one at a time, mixing after each. And then you're going to add a tablespoon of vanilla extract. If you have your own extract, then you can also take 2 vanilla beans out and squeeze the seeds into that mixture. Before I made my own vanilla extract, I didn't bother with this, but now I just take the bean out and squeeze the seeds out, and then I just stick the bean back in there because there's still good stuff in there. So if you have your own quart of vanilla extract with lots of beans in it, you can do that. If not, don't worry about it. And then the thing that I add that's different from the original recipe is I put in about a tablespoon of almond extract. And I think that gives it a nice sort of almond punch. I love the smell of almond extract too. There's just something really, you're like, oh, cookies with
Yes.
almond extract.
It's got kind of the marzipan
Yes, I
feeling.
think that's what it is. And it just says it's like the cooking version of the onions cooking for dinner. It's like, oh, something
Good,
wonderful
isn't
cooking is coming.
it?
So you're going to cream all that stuff together, and then you're going to mix together 4 cups of flour, a teaspoon of salt, and a tablespoon of baking powder. And you'll put that in. And so you get kind of a slightly dry but a little bit sticky dough. And then what I usually do is fold in by hand 2.5 cups of the sliced almonds. I usually toast those and then cool them. If you're going to toast them, then you should have them completely cooled.
And how do you toast them?
I just toast them in my toaster oven, and I try and pay attention and not let them burn. Always our work.
I toasted mine in a frying pan on the stove, which you do have to, I think, stand over it. Maybe more. Well, either way, you really got to watch them because it's easy for them to burn. But if you do it on the stove, then you have to kind of keep mixing it.
And you don't want to over toast them because then they can get kind of bitter. But that said, in a pinch, I have sometimes just thrown them in there without toasting them, and I think it's fine too. So I think maybe you get a little bit more nice toasty almond taste when you toast them, but don't worry about it if you don't have time. So you're going to fold in the 2.5 cups of those sliced almonds. So those are the thin ones.
You can get at Costco a big bag, which is nice, gotta say.
They used to have it at BJ's and they don't anymore. So you need to mail me some big Costco bags if you want biscotti. No, and then what you're going to do, now I have a half sheet pan, so I use one of those. I line it with parchment, and then I basically divide the dough into three clumps and basically rollers, just shape it out into three logs on that one cookie sheet. So they're pretty long, and then they're maybe about 1.5 to 2 inches wide.
They will spread out a bit when they're cooking. So you don't want them right next to each other. They need some room to grow. Not so, well, a little bit in length, but more in width.
Mainly with, And as you know, I like to do everything with one pan. So that's why I've developed this method
Yes.
cooking them in that log shape, three on one pan. And you cook it at about 350 degrees for 30 minutes. I usually use the convection feature until they're kind of lightly brown. Then you want to cool them for 20 minutes. You can leave them on the pan. You'll see you can take them off in one big log. And you want to slice them diagonally about 1/2 inch wide. And then you're going to lay them out again on the cookie sheet with the cut side down and cook them for about 5 minutes at 350. And I usually take them out, flip them. Put them back in for another 5 minutes on the other side, and that's why they're twice baked.
Exactly. Yes. And you could dip them in chocolate if you want, white chocolate, you can do whatever, add some peppermint.
If you really like nuts, I mean, I like this because it gets a nice almondy, but you could dip in chocolate and then dip it in more almonds.
And you probably could use other nuts too if you wanted to in the biscotti. Let us know if you try it with something else.
Well, and I will say one of the things that you will notice that you will get crumbs and chunks that you won't get perfect slices. And then you've also got the ends. So maybe you have a husband who is always willing to eat the what we call the biscotti butts.
I was the one eating all the biscotti butts. And yeah, my daughter came home and I was like, "You need to help me. I'm eating all of these." Did you say you let the logs cool for 20 minutes?
Yeah, for 20 minutes because it will be hard to cut them. And I usually use a bread knife to cut.
Yes.
You want to kind of saw them.
Right.
You don't want us pushing down on them.
Exactly. I think when you take the logs out, if they're too hot, it's going to be sort of cake-like.
And they're too soft,
They're too soft to cut. And if you wait too long, then they will be more crumbly and you'll get more pieces. So that sweet spot, I think, is about 20 minutes after you pull them out of the oven.
And this will make the sizes won't be super uniform. I don't really care about that. I would say just made a batch and I bagged them up. I had, I think, 5 bags of 10 or 12, I think, good sized ones.
When I made my mine, I made my logs much wider. So, do whatever you feel like, really, because if you want to make less cookies but bigger, Or if you want to make more cookies and smaller, then you make your logs narrower.
Yeah, I brought them once to a cookie swap, and I think we have to bring something like 6 or 8 dozen, which was a lot.
Yeah, it
So
is.
those things were very narrow and quite thin too.
Right.
I think I did a double double batch, and I ended up with them, and I made them a little bit, you know. The other thing that I do, because you will have little pieces, and you can have people eat those, but one thing I do is I'll take them and dump them into a bag and put them in the freezer. And then there's a really good old English trifle recipe in the silver palette that calls for biscotti. And I use this recipe to make the biscotti. And I use leftover biscotti.
Bits. Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah,
But yeah,
definitely.
and we
Well,
could probably put a link to that, because that's a good Christmas. I think it's called like the English Christmas trifle or something like that.
excellent. Well, thank you, Bossy. That's excellent recipe. Moving on, we are talking about, we are actually, if you can believe it, finishing the book, No Idle Hands, The Social History of American Knitting by Anne MacDonald. These last two chapters, chapter 15 is called Knitting from A to Z, Argyles to Zimmerman. An excellent title. And then chapter 16 is Knitting Now and Whither Knit. That's the last chapter.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to say again that the husband gave me this book last year for Christmas, and it has been the subject of many fruitful conversations. I love our conversations about this book because, well, we've learned so much about the history of knitting, but also the way that it takes knitting as a lens for looking at trends in American history, particularly for women. So you can kind of trace women's history, which tends not to be the history that any of us studied that much, through this particular lens. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Doug. And it's been a great conversation, not just with you, but also with mom and with other knitters and my children, my husband. Who doesn't want to learn about
Yeah, because it's always fun to sort of, especially in these last couple of chapters, it covers when we were actually on the earth. And I have to say, the other thing about this book, it is incredibly well researched. Well, not only does she send out calls for people to write to her about their experience, and she quotes a lot from those, but she goes into the archives and looks at these knitting pamphlets and McCall's and Vogue and everything. And I have many times gone and looked up her references, and they're always spot on, which considering, I mean, I have to imagine she had some giant box full of like 3x5 index cards that she was keeping track of all of this stuff. And boy, she didn't miss anything. And that is just so impressive, particularly for when she did this.
I agree. Yeah, she says at the beginning that she just got inundated with letters pouring in and stories and bravo. Thank you.
Yeah, but then also just her own research in various archives was
Right.
just super impressive. Yeah. Well, so Booty, how would you characterize what happens? So we've come out of World War II. We're kind of in the 50s now. How would you characterize this period?
Well, we have women returning back to the home from Rosie the Riveter. Now, those jobs are have gone back to the men that came back from war, and they're trapped, really. They're at home. They have all these appliances which are supposed to be making their lives easier, but it turns out that the trap is that now they expect sheets to be washed several times a week, and they're used to getting used to, vacuuming once a
Right.
day. And so it's not so much And she talked about this a little earlier too, but I loved when Anne
Okay.
McDonald says that women are trapped in a squirrel cage of modern appliance packed plate glass and broad-loomed split level or ranch houses or modern apartments, which feminist writer Betty Friedan described some years later as, quote, comfortable concentration camps.
Which, given the context of what everybody knew of concentration camps, I think it was particularly stunning to me when I read that. I loved what this one, because I mean, it's true. We so love our time-saving appliances, but there's this the trap. I mean, that was the metaphor that keeps coming back is a trap. And this one woman, she says, last week when my dryer broke down, the sheets didn't get changed for 8 days. Everyone complained. We all felt dirty. I felt guilty. Isn't that silly?
Yeah.
She was washing the whole family's sheets twice a week, Booty.
Right. No, that's a
No.
no
That's a hard no. That's a hard no.
no.
Even if I had a new washer and dryer, I would not wash everybody's sheets. But then once you start doing it, then everybody feels dirty.
Right. It's the, yeah, it's the trap. Well, and women are getting married younger. In fact, our mom, hi mom,
Hi, Mom.
took a survey at her dining room where she lives, and our mom got married when she was 19. That was the youngest at the table. But most of the other women got married around 20. That was fairly typical for the time in the 1950s. And the birth rate, this is the baby boomer era, the birth rates were actually almost as high as India.
Well, and that, they're coming back from the war, and I mean, it's a profound push to basically repopulate, and you can see women obviously are needed for that little project. The marriage rate had been, I looked it up consistently since the 1900s, about 21, 21 and a half, drops to 20. But then McDonald says there are 14 million girls who were engaged by 17 or pre-engaged or engaged to be engaged. But and then you have declining female college enrollment, which it was kind of a surprise to me. And 60% of already matriculated women in college candidly confess they were there to find a man and dropped out to marry.
Well, and we should say that although our mother got married at 19 and she was in college, she followed our dad to California where he was getting a graduate degree. But he really insisted that she stay in college, and she was very grateful that she did.
But I think that was atypical. And even though she was married at 19, she didn't have our brother, the one who doesn't listen to the podcast.
Although we should tell the story of how she was 19 and she was at some place where I don't know, it was California or it was on the way to California, where she wanted to get a glass of wine or something. And the drinking age was 21. And the waitress said, can I see some ID or something like that? And our mother held up her wedding ring and said, see, I'm married. And the woman said, hell, honey, that don't mean a thing. I was married at 14.
I don't think I ever heard that story. Yeah, I mean the emphasis if you did go to college tended to be on the infamous MRS degree, and I hadn't heard this term, getting your PhD, which stood for putting hubby through. So, women are having babies, they're supporting they're cleaning, and as one woman from Pittsburgh said, I feel like a pie being cut into six pieces and served to a dinner party of 10.
Who here can relate to
Yeah.
that?
And another woman said, I've been married 10 years and I still feel that my husband expects me to be a combination of Fanny Farmer and Marilyn Monroe. Oh my God, is that capture the bind that women are in, where there's this incredible pressure to repopulate the earth and But at the same time, women are going to college, and there's all those expectations too that they be everything to everybody.
Right. And in terms of knitting, we have the Korean War. So you still have knitting for the GIs. And of course, there's a big push by the US government to get people to knit. We have, quote, "Let's not forget those fellows who are doing their bit for us in the service of our country. It may be your brother, a school friend, or the love of your life, but don't forget to let him know you remember. He's the one who's trying to make a better world for you and me. Here's the GI turtleneck sweater. For this one, he'll be grateful to you forevermore." And of course, we still have
Socks
socks.
and more socks.
Yeah.
But this is the period of the Argyle craze where everybody's making Argyle
Well,
socks.
it's really the continuation,
Yeah, that's.
the Argyle sock craze. I mean, this is a fad that has really lasted longer than most, right? Because I mean, it was the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, Argyles.
But I did like the story of one mom who was knitting socks for her son. He was a cadet in military school. She decided that she could tell he didn't love his uniforms. So she started knitting him black socks, but then she put in, like, in October, in November, there were little pumpkins and then Christmas trees and then red hearts for Valentine's Day and Easter eggs. So it was a little bit of rebellion, but just under the cuffs of his pants so superiors couldn't see it. And I love the idea of the mother and sons collaborating in this rebellion against
Yeah,
the
conspiring. Well, and I think that embroidering something like that is a great way to take something and make it unique. So as the holidays are approaching, I felt like, oh, that's a really great idea for just embellishing something rather than knitting the whole sock, but just doing a little something.
And this is also when, because women are stretched so thin and being cut into six pieces for a party of 10, this is where you get the emergence of the Jiffy knits. We've seen it a little bit before, but the giant knitting needles with the super bulky weight, you can make something in a weekend because women don't have as much time.
Right. And that continues on in through the 80s, not to get ahead of ourselves here, but that, right. What do you make when women are going back to work and now they're not at home as much, so they only have the weekend to do something, make something really quick.
Yeah, I do remember knitting for my niece a blanket. She had seen like a blanket with really thick yarn. I mean, I would say the yarn was probably like half an inch thick. I knit it on size 50 needles, and it was like knitting with entrails at a wedding. And like weaving in the ends too. And at first when I started, I was like, this is great. And it did knit up pretty fast. But I think I only knit one because it just was not fun to knit.
Yeah, never tried to do that thick of yarn. That is, yeah. Jiffy quick. Okay, so let's talk about the three graces of knitting.
Yes, this is where we get the emergence of three women who we all owe these women a debt that we would not have the resources that we all have at our fingertips and on YouTube were it not for Mary Walker Phillips, Elizabeth Zimmerman, and Barbara Walker were sort of what Bootie and I are calling the three graces of knitting. Do you want to say something about them, Bootie?
Well, Mary Walker Phillips wrote Creative Knitting, a New Art Form, and she wrote many books and also had exhibits and workshops. I think Most of us are familiar with Elizabeth Zimmerman. Probably her most famous book is Knitting Without Tears, and apparently has never been out of print since she wrote it. I think she was known for seamless top-down sweaters, wool, only knitting with wool. She also did a lot of videos. She's sort of like the Julia Child of knitting because she had these instructional videos.
I think the comparison to between her and Julia Child is really a good one, in that she made certain basics of knitting available to everybody. And yeah, I don't think we would have so many knitting tutorials on YouTube were it not for Elizabeth Zimmerman and insisting that everybody use at least the best quality materials that were available to them, which this is kind of the era of. There's a lot of crappy acrylic that, and that idea that everybody can knit and knit without tears, and the value of using the best material available to you.
Well, I thought it was interesting. She got her start by she published a pattern in a magazine, and I forget which one it was. But she didn't get paid for the pattern, but they said you can get the wool for this pattern from her. So she was originally selling yarn. And then she got into the writing books and doing the videos and also having retreats, basically, where women would come. And there was this woman who came every year. She drove from far away. And just for that once a year being together, the coming together was really important. And now her daughter has continued in that tradition, Meg Swanson. She's well known for carrying the tradition on. And then the third Grace would be Barbara Walker, who's a researcher. Got her degree in journalism, but she went into the Library of Congress and put together two treasures of knitting patterns that culled hundreds of knitting stitches.
So each a little bit different in their emphasis, but I think we owe Barbara Walker and Elizabeth Zimmerman and Mary Walker Phillips a huge debt, in that the resources that we have available to all of us, and then just kind of the guiding principles too. And the community. I loved what one woman said about how she just felt connected to other women. She said, "I'm instantly drawn to other knitters. It's almost as if we're possessors of different chromosomes than non-knitters." And I get such pleasure from talking to with them. We seem to share the same vocabularies, even though we may be absolute strangers. And I do think there's a way that there's a vocabulary to knitting that I think when you first come to knitting, you're much more aware of that, because everything seems like it's in code and like, what's 2K mean? But that you quickly get used to that vocabulary. But I think that's one of the things that we all share. We certainly have seen that, like at Rhinebeck. You can go up to somebody and ask them, what's that pattern? And nobody will look at you like, don't ask me about that.
There are people that actually wear like a little tag that says, this is the pattern, this is the yarn. These are the needles.
No, and that kind of, I think it's a community of sharing the same language, but also enjoying in the learning together. And that curiosity, I think, is the other thing that characterizes the knitting community. But Booty, knitting also, as McDonald points out, cures a lot of ailments. It cures nail biting. So if you're biting your nails, just pick up your needles, and it's hard to bite your nails while you're also knitting, so that helps that. It cures arthritis. One woman said knitting in the morning helped a woman banish, quote, Mr. Arthur from her hands. She called her arthritis Mr. Arthur. I thought that was a great idea, to call all of our ailments They're like little people that inhabit our bodies and take over our hands, but then we banish them when we knit in the morning.
Exactly.
Anxiety, and we've talked about that. Tell about agoraphobia, because I thought this was great.
There's this woman, her therapist told her to take her knitting, drive somewhere. And so normally, if she went out, she would have to kind of run back home because she was afraid. And instead, she would drive somewhere and sit with her knitting. And then she had to stay. So it sort of forced her to get through that feeling of fear. She wasn't even able to leave her house. She wasn't able to work, obviously, do anything. So she was able to get back to work. And she said she still kept knitting because she enjoyed it, but she didn't have time to knit as much because she was out doing more things. And yeah, so that was really interesting to me, that as a way of sort of getting you through a fear or stressful time.
Yeah, it's almost like a exposure therapy of working your way further and further. You know, first go into the driveway and sit in your car and knit, then
Right.
go down the block, then,
Right.
you know, eventually. And then overeating and smoking cigarettes, although Michelle Lee Bernstein claims that you can eat Cheetos if you use chopsticks while you're knitting. And I liked what Charles Higginbotham, he owned a trendy knitting shop in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. He designed fashionable knits like, quote, the sobering puff-sleeved cardigan, which he called the national debt. But he said he could not tolerate people who say they are in too impatient to knit. Higginbotham's rebuts. They ought to say, I should learn to knit because I'm impatient. So knitting
Absolutely.
cures impatience.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is so true. So if you, because a lot of people will say their kids are too squirrely to knit, and I say, well, it might help.
Yeah, because they do have to focus and keeping their hands busy.
Yeah.
But and also this is in the 70s. I mean you're younger than me, but knitting cures boredom when you're waiting in the long line for gas during the gas shortage in the 1970s. A lot of people sat there apparently and knit. I do think we have to tell our story.
About running out of gas. So I'll start. We'll see how I.
Start and then I'll correct you.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it
Yes.
was
Good
in
start, Betty.
Colorado. We were going up a mountain in, I believe, the Volkswagen camper
Yeah,
bus.
this was the hippie era where we had a Volkswagen camper bus. Yeah, and we were actually coming down a mountain.
Okay,
Thank
going.
God,
You're right.
because
We're coasting
coming,
in.
we were
Yes.
coming down Cameron Pass and we ran out of gas. So there's, you know, mom, dad, four kids in the Volkswagen camper van.
Probably a dog.
Probably a dog. I think that was when we had a Great Dane, actually,
Yeah.
Sabina, the Black Great Dane. So I think we had four kids, a Great Dane in the Volkswagen camper, and we run out of gas and basically we're able to coast down Cameron Pass. And Dad knows that there's a gas station at the bottom. We coast into the gas station, and the gas station is out of gas,
Yeah.
which that never happens now, but that was pretty common in the 1970s that you could, or at least during that period, where you could go to a gas station and they wouldn't actually have any gas to sell. So we're sitting there, this guy in a Colorado State Forestry truck pulls up. And we should say that Dad was an assistant professor at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and he taught botany, which meant that he, I think, probably every student who was in the forestry program probably had to take botany with Dad. And so this guy gets out of the forestry truck, and Dad goes over and says, Hey, do you think maybe we could siphon like a gallon out of your tank? And the young man looks at him and he says, "Well, this is state property." And then he looks at Dad a little more closely and he says, "Are you Dr. Klein?" And Dad's like, "Yes, yes, I am." He says, "I had botany with you." And Dad's thinking, "Great." And he says, "Oh, well, oh." It was, "You gave me a C." And Dad says, "Well, you're working on a B."
Then he gave him the gas.
Then he gave him a gallon of gas, and we were able to get. And I'm sure when he saw these poor little kids standing there too, but that happened, and people would siphon tanks.
Very strange times. But, well, we should wrap up. We have so enjoyed this book. And thanks again to Doug for suggesting it. And thank you to Anne McDonald for writing it. I do believe she's no longer with us, but we loved it. So when you're in the throes of your holiday knitting panic, or your,
Reading wine somewhere.
yeah, or
Remember,
your,
hey, at least you can get gas.
right, at least you can get, or if you're just knitting, you're calmly knitting for yourself. Now you know a little bit about how we got here, how knitting is no longer something you do for thrift.
Nope.
And if you're knitting today, you know that so well because
Not saving any money.
you're not saving any money. And all of your family and friends should really appreciate the fact that you not only did you spend all your money on the yarn, but all your time knitting.
But well, Booty, what are you knitting these days?
Well, unfortunately, I was on Sleeve Island for my Tide Line cardigan by Marie Green. And then I tried it on and I was like, too tight on the
Oh.
slips. Yeah, I had knit maybe half of one sleeve. So I ripped it out and I'm trying again. So basically, what I did to loosen it up was two things. I picked up a few more stitches around and I decided to use a bigger needle. Hopefully that'll work. So what are you knitting?
Well, I haven't been, well, because I've been making 10,000 biscotti and doing the whole Christmas thing. I don't know why every year I'm like, I mean, Christmas does come at the same time every year at the same speed. And yet I always feel like, oh my God, here we are again. So I've been making a lot of marshmallows and biscotti and getting ready for that. So I have been doing a little bit of knitting on my Schneeflocken, and I started the Goldwing, and I'm really liking it. Just in general, I'm really liking doing color work. I feel like I've gotten more competent in the using two yarns and the continental and the American or British at the same time. I have to say, when I first started, I was like, I'm not going to possibly be able to do this. But now I'm really enjoying it, and I see more color work in my future.
More pies and more color work.
More
Yes.
pies, more biscotti, more marshmallows.
That is excellent. Yeah.
But I'm so glad we read this book and learned a lot from it. I have to tell one other story about Dad that I just thought of.
Okay.
Well, it's sort of another student story, since this one was about the encounter with his one student. He came home one time, I remember, and said, "I just got the greatest student evaluation." And Mom said, "Oh, what did they write?" And he said, "The student wrote, 'After I took Dr. Klein's class, I want to pave the entire state of Colorado.'" And Mom was like, "What? Why are you excited by that, you know.
Yeah, why is that a good evaluation?
Because if I can make somebody feel that strongly about something, even if it's negative, then I feel I've done my job. I've pulled them out of their comfort zone.
I've overwhelmed them.
I've overwhelmed them with, yeah, even if it's saying, but I have to say, you know, every holiday, I think when we're thinking about family and making things, and you know, I treasure those stories, because I think what Dad was really good at was reframing things.
Yes. And for you working on a bee.
Working on a bee, I can make him feel that strongly about something, and I think that's such a gift. And I want to say thank you to that student who wrote that on their course evaluation, because I have laughed about that so many times, and it has brought such joy. And thank you to that student who worked for the state of Colorado in the Department of Forestry, who gave us a gallon of gas.
Okay, I want to tell one more story. This isn't a story about Dad. I have a friend whose son, when he was, I believe, is in elementary school, so either elementary or middle school, he went into the cafeteria. His parents had filled his account with money. I don't know how much money they had put in there, but he bought all the cookies. And he sat at this table and said, "Cookies for everyone." And that's what I felt like when I was giving out the biscotti at my book club. Cookies for everyone. So you too, if you make the biscotti, you can say cookies for everyone.
Yes, I think it's that spirit of cookies for everyone. You're working on a bee. You know, how can you take something and see it in the best possible light
Yeah.
that makes us smile and connects us to one another? And I think that's the best of what this season is about. And I think it's time to say, whatever you do, don't
Don't knit
knit like
like
my
sister.
but do make the biscotti, do work on the bee, and do look at everything in a positive light, because there is always an upside. And check out our website, bootyandbossy.com.